Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Social Watch fights to put people's needs before capital at the G20.
We focus on the G20 and the summit at the United Nations. The G20 countries are the architects of the global economic crisis, many of them.
In protest is Social Watch, who will be unveiling their 2009 report, People First. Social Watch is also in the United States to lobby the attendees of the UN General Assembly meeting to respond to the economic crisis of developing and the poorest countries.
Now, Social Watch fights to put people's needs before capital at the G20 with Janice Silverman, coordinator of campaigns of Social Watch, an NGO network monitoring poverty eradication and gender equality. Roberto Bisio, coordinator of Social Watch and executive director of the Third World Institute located in Uruguay. And Amitabh Behar, co-coordinator of Social Watch in India. And it's a pleasure to have all of you with us.
Thanks to you, Mimi.
And you can't see this, Jana and Amitabh, but I'm sitting here and Ken and I are feeling the heat from the hot off the press, wonderful, really gorgeous looking Social Watch report 2009 that Roberto was kind enough to bring up to us. So we're going to start in earnest by getting, we're going to unembargo it and get some of the insights from this very important report, People First. And thank you for bringing us our copies, Roberto.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's really a people's report. It includes the conclusion from civil society organizations in 61 countries, and they are reporting on how the global crisis is affecting them.
Jana, I just want to begin with yourself. You're in Pittsburgh now, and just give us a sense of the importance of this gathering.
Well, basically, we're here to share views that are reflecting what's being expressed in our 2009 report, which is basically saying that the best way out of the crisis, not just in terms of to fulfill the criteria of social justice, but also as a sort of good business practice or good economic practice, is actually to invest in people. As we well know, as listeners in New York well know, that the bailouts last year have only benefited the bankers on Wall Street, while, you know, the people are, well, maybe a few of the bankers from Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns have had to sell their multi-million-dollar apartments. There's more than 3 million people who've lost their mortgages. And if we look at the cases in developing countries, the situation is even more stark because the issues of workers who are migrant workers who are beginning to return to their countries who cannot send back the remittances that used to send back and that are now actually meaning that people now have less access to education, jobs, healthcare, the basic necessities of life. And so if recovery packages don't deal with these kind of issues as well, there's no way that we'll be able to find a just solution to the crisis.
Amitabh, if you could build on what Jana was talking about, but be more specific as to the experience of India and the crisis.
I would just build on that and say that, in fact, it's been 1 year now, and all the bailout packages have, in fact, further excluded the poor and the marginalized. With the financial crisis and was also a hope that there would be some restructuring in terms of the financial relationships, in terms of the economic order. But all that we have seen over the past 1 year are policies which have, in fact, led only to poor becoming poorer. And there is existing food crisis. In a country like India, we have, even according to our own government estimates, 30% people living without 3 square meals a day. From our report, we can also tell you from the Social Watch report that almost 50% of the income is spent by the poor on food. So what we're looking at is a worsening of poverty and marginalization in the wake of the global financial crisis. Though we are also hoping that, given that this could have been an opportunity to restructure this free market neoliberal capitalist framework, that's really not happened.
The world has changed a lot in the last decade, previous precisely to the crisis. because there used to be that the South was indebted. We were talking about debt, and it was always referred to Southern countries being indebted because of some irresponsibility of their leaders in how they spent their money. What is happening now is that the so-called G7 countries, the richest countries of the world, are all of them highly indebted countries at this moment. They have been spending beyond their means. They are highly indebted. And the creditor countries are some of the poorest countries of the world. China, India, Brazil are now creditors of the United States. Now, this is a very odd situation. This is not how things should have been. The idea around the liberalization of financial exchanges, the creation of a single global market for finances, was that the market brings in the demand and the offer. So where the money was abundant was the offer, and where the money was needed was in the poorest countries. Therefore, the money should have gone in form of investment, in form of capital transfer from the rich countries to the poor countries. What happened in practice was the other way around, that the money is flowing from the poorest countries of the world to the rich countries, from some of them. And that is nonsense, really. And that kind of liberalization is behind what created the crisis. So much money coming into the United States, lent by China, lent by Brazil, lent by India even, although India not so much. Where was that money going to? Everybody talks about the subprime, the mortgage crisis, how people were given loans when they couldn't pay back. But the problem was that all that money coming in had to go somewhere. And therefore, the people were almost forcing people to contract mortgages, to borrow money that perhaps they didn't need or that they couldn't pay back. That's one of the aspects of the crisis. That's one of the aspects of the whole malfunctioning of the global finances. So we were expecting a re-regulation, a reorientation. We were expecting, after realization of how it all collapsed, and how it all collapsed and the losses were socialized. All around the world, the taxpayers are paying for to keep the bankrupt banks alive. Now, that nonsense has not been brought to an end, and the restructuring of international finances has not yet happened. And the agenda of Pittsburgh, in a way, those issues are in there. Some countries have debated that the kind of bonuses that the banks pay to their employees are really nonsense because they don't motivate people to invest wisely. They just motivate them to get short-term earnings. And so, therefore, that practice should be abandoned. That is a proposal that France and Germany have made. But it is resisted by others. As we know, some people don't want major changes in the whole global finances. Other countries, the new creditors like Brazil and China, they are worried that their assets nominated in dollars might lose their value if the dollar devalues in relation with other currencies. The dollar is right now at its lowest value ever in relation with the euro, for example, as any American wanting to travel to Europe would notice, you know, that you can buy very little with dollars right now. That is a problem for the countries that have invested their savings in dollars because they are seeing their savings deteriorating in that sense. And so they are wondering whether some other forms of having international reserves should be established, should be go back to the gold standard that was prevailing until basically Nixon in 71 got rid of it, or shall we create a kind of new international currency, as has been proposed, among others, by Joseph Stiglitz, economist and Nobel Prize winner, that made that suggestion to the General Assembly of the United Nations. So those are issues that in a sense, if we talked about them a year ago or 2 years ago, we would be called, are you crazy? But now they are really in the agenda of the heads of state.
Now, one of the things, again, I'm just looking at this, and it's appropriately, maybe, in red, the report from Social Watch People First, and just some of the statistics that are printed in a summary on the back cover. Peru, for example, 200,000 layoffs, as well as a fall in the purchasing power of wages and savings. In the Benin, the price of maize, the most widely consumed product, soared 220%. Sub-Saharan Africa, women continue to be the first to lose their jobs and are increasingly finding themselves engaged in petty informal trading of vegetables and tomatoes as a coping mechanism. And we could go on and on and on. India, there's been drastically reduced growth in personal and consumer loans and industrial production. Amitabh, I just want to, within the context of this, aside from painting a picture of what this economic crisis has meant, I wondered if you have thoughts on this, because the last time members of Social Watch were here, one of the things we listened to was President Rafael Correa of Ecuador talk about the elimination, if you will, of the International Monetary Fund as very much a part of the problem. I was hoping you might give us some of your thoughts on both the impact as well as looking at these financial mechanisms of capital and what they really have done in the world community. Amitabh?
I would, in fact, largely agree with the thought of doing away with IMF and the World Bank, the way they function, which are totally undemocratic, where you have seven countries controlling the entire financial architecture of the globe with vetoes for the U.S. and the European Union. And these policies, the policies that these financial institutions pursue, have only caused havoc and devastation in the poor countries of the South. So there is an urgent need to totally restructure these bodies and start looking at more democratic, participatory institutions. And I would say that, in fact, it would be very, very critical that we don't end up only ensuring participation of governments, but we need to also look at participation of citizens and civil society group if we really want to do a turnaround from the perspective of the poor. Because given the condition, the way the policies are pursued, it's usually the rich who benefit. Even in a country like India, where we've been looking at a 9 to 10% growth rate over the past 6-7 years, after the financial crisis, it's come down to 6%. But again, the worst affected are the poor, marginal farmers, are the women, and it's also people in the informal sector. So there's an urgent need to totally restructure the financial institutions, global financial institutions.
Jano, in terms of all of these organizations, the IMF, the World Bank, the G20, one of the organizations that we don't hear that much about, and we heard it from you when you were with us in June, was the United Nations as a force in this conversation. You were here in June talking about the UN conference on the world financial and economic crisis, and I know that's why Roberto is in the U.S. in New York now. So why don't you tell us a bit about what happened in June and how that lays the basis for the United Nations to get involved, which, of course, represents a much wider number of countries than the G20.
Right. Well, the June conference in New York at the United Nations was a historic opportunity. It was the first time that all of the world's countries, the so-called G192, which is the number of countries in the United Nations General Assembly, were able to voice their opinions about what they believe is the way out of the crisis, taking into consideration not just the needs of the rich countries or the so-called emerging countries such as India and China, but the countries, the least developed countries, small island nations that have always been the forgotten countries on the world scenario. And the outcome document of the UN conference was interesting, although maybe some of the proposals weren't quite as radical as some civil society activists had wanted. It did reaffirm the fact that the rich countries were responsible for the crisis and therefore must take into account poor countries who are suffering the impacts without having been responsible for its creation. It also talks about giving more policy space for developing countries who are being hit hard by the protectionist measures of rich countries, which are using that as one of their responses to the crisis. And it also emphasizes the need for a more systemic reform of the international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. And this is extremely important when we consider that when we look at what the G20 and the G8 has proposed, is basically throwing a lot more money at the IMF and World Bank, at $1.1 trillion to be exact, but without demanding any kind of substantial reforms in return. So and from the UN, there's a recognition that the global financial architecture needs to be fundamentally changed in order to prevent these crises from occurring again.
One of the things that, again, just looking at some statistics that have been floated, in this case by the UN, they speak about 222 million workers running the risk of joining the ranks of the working poor, which for them means earning less than $1.25 a day. And another issue that we haven't mentioned, which is creating tremendous hardships, is the remittance flows, which reached $328 billion in 2008, and they're about to drop 7.3% in 2009. Another issue that was raised was that hunger rates are up in every region in the world, so that there is the crisis is of astronomical proportion. And I should say in our own country that there's a rejuvenation, if you will, of the economy, but without the workers coming along with it, without jobs. So how do your recommendations and how do the considerations of Social Watch, et cetera, Roberto, address what is to be done fundamentally on this dire crisis and with such a multiplicity of problems?
The problems are indeed enormous. It is always been said that crisis also means opportunity. Now, the opportunity with this crisis is, on the one hand, the opportunity to really reform international finances. Now, 40 countries are about to be unable to pay their obligations because the commodities they export have dropped so dramatically. They don't have the income and so on. So there is going to be, we are on the eve of a major debt crisis. Now, that means you have to have mechanisms of moratorium, at least for a while. Like when the tsunami came in, the countries affected were allowed not to pay their debts until they could recover from the catastrophe. Well, the crisis is a catastrophe of a similar thing, so you have to give those countries a space. And you also have to create a tribunal, like in the case of bankruptcies, that decides how much of that debt really ought to be paid. Now, there is the opportunity to establish precisely that. Who is going to tell those countries, among them some of the poorest in the world, that they have to pay anyhow, even when their people are suffering hunger, when really big corporations are not allowed to go bankrupt and they are being rescued? So why, during many years, we have said that what we need in order to eradicate poverty from the world is $100 billion a year of aid. And we've been told that's inconceivable, there isn't that money, so how can you demand that kind of things and so on. Now, when big corporations were facing problems, not just hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars appeared to rescue them. Where was that money? So how could that be created? And the problem of really getting rid of extreme poverty around the world. What we are talking about is not providing a car for each family. It's providing three meals a day for each child. That's the point. And that can be done. We have the resources, we have the knowledge, we have the expertise to do that. What is missing is the political will. Now, that should be in the agenda. And countries that have started to do that kind of thing, what they have found out is that by doing that, you really recover the economy. by providing poor women in Brazil with an income of $60 a month, you activate local economies to an enormous proportion. So that is the best rescue package, is really to invest in people, to create the jobs, to provide people with an opportunity. That will reactivate the economy much more than socializing the losses of big banks and big corporations.
Amitad, what else needs to be done, or perhaps what needs to be undone?
I think Roberto has already said it. And as he said, I was reading somewhere that in the last 1 year, the money which has come in for the bailout has been 50 times the amount which was done for ODA. So there's a clear lack of political will. And in terms of the solution, I think what Roberto is saying is very central to the solution, that we need to start looking at a recovery package which is based on keeping people first, where people are at the center. So you are trying to build an economy from the bottom and not by bailing out bankrupt banks and highly paid executives. And I think it's very, very crucial for an audience here to appreciate that we are not talking about, as Roberto said, poverty, about getting cars, but in a country like India, it's about survival, it's about dignity, it's about getting education, it's about getting basic vaccinations, so infant mortality rate, it is about basic food. So there has to be a complete turnaround of the way we look at our economies and where we keep the poor and the marginalized at the center and then build the economy upward. So let's also hope that we can probably see this as an opportunity. But at this moment, the signs coming from G20 are quite contrary to that. And I think there is a need for a strong civil society protest and urging its own governments and the G20 to change course.
And Jen, I just want to know, what do you think needs to be done in terms of increasing the clout of the developing nations and the poorest countries? And we have about a minute and a half left. And, of course, we want to tell people where they can get copies of this remarkable and important report. Jenna?
Well, I think what needs to be done, not just in developing countries, but also in developed countries, is change the balance of power between workers and capital, which is the workers' movement and the women's movement and the movement of the poorest people in developing countries as well has been on the defensive since the 1970s. And I think this is our opportunity to start reclaiming that power, because without protest, without struggle, there is no rights, as has been said. And so I think this is the best way. And I'm just using a very quick example. In where I and Roberto live in Uruguay, this is a country where about 4 years ago, a left-wing government supported by the trade unions came into power. And since that time, because of the shifting sort of the terms of debate, workers, collective bargaining has gone up, workers' salaries have gone up, minimum wage has gone up, the social security benefits have gone up, and Uruguay isn't suffering the same impacts of the crisis that we see in the United States or that we see in other countries in Africa or Asia. And so I think this is the key. We need to, through struggle, we can take back what the bosses have been stealing from us over the last 30 years, and that's the only way that we can find a just solution to the crisis for those who are suffering its impacts.
And if you want to put some theoretical meat on the bones that Roberto and Amitabh and Jana have been discussing with us, you can go to www.socialwatch.org. Hey, that's easy, socialwatch.org, and you can download the full version of the report or order printed copies from a Social Watch, and the report is People First, and that's exactly where it's at. And a special thanks to Roberto Bisio, coordinator of Social Watch and executive director of the Third World Institute in Uruguay, and Amitabh Biha, co-coordinator of Social Watch in India, and Jana Silverman, coordinator of campaigns of Social Watch and NGO network monitoring poverty eradication, and gender equality. We'll have you on lots more because each time we do, we get some real constructive ideas around which to organize. Thank you for being with us.
No, thanks to you.
Sure don't want to rob. Don't give me no charity. Just offer me a job and I'll be productive. I'll pay my taxes to the state. The best not away.
And that's Eddie Starr. Hey, still talking about revolution. The revolution. Jobs. Jobs at living wages. Still the issue, as well as redistributing the wealth to those who created it. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.